You're listening to The Robin and Boom Show, engaging the contemporary world with the great tradition. Find us on our YouTube channel, our Facebook page, or on our website at robinmarkphillips.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. Now, here's today's co-host, Robin Phillips.
I'm Robin Phillips.
And I'm Jason Van Boom.
So thank you for joining us today. I'm going to begin with introductions. I'll introduce myself. As you know, I'm Robin Phillips, and I grew up in the Pacific Northwest of America. And after spending 10 years in England, I moved to the Coeur d'Alene, Idaho area. And I'm a student in history with a keen interest in music, education, culture, and theology. I have a master's in historical theology from King's College London, and I'm currently working on a second master's degree in library science from the University of Oklahoma. For most of my career, I've worked as a freelance writer and researcher, both in the business sector as well as within academia. And I'm the author of the book Saints and Scoundrels, and I operate a blog at robinmarkphillips.com. And you can use that blog to find links and updates and information regarding this podcast. So, Jason, can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Right, sure. Well, I'm originally from California. I'm now living and teaching in Europe. Specifically, I'm in Estonia, which is known as a pioneer in digital communications and applying these to society. Estonia is a dynamic little democratic country next to Finland, close to St. Petersburg, Russia. Now, my background is a little bit unusual in that it's both Catholic and Muslim. I've studied the great books, Thomas Aquinas and church history at mainly Catholic schools, especially Thomas Aquinas College in Santa Paula, California. For although I was a Muslim in the Sufi and Shia traditions, after returning to Christianity, I've been teaching and studying in Estonia. I'm writing my PhD thesis in the Theology and Religious Studies faculty at the University of Tartu. I'm also teaching a course there on philosophy and medieval religious thought.
Even though Jason lives in Europe, we met in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho through a mutual friend when he was visiting my Orthodox parish in Post Falls, St. John the Baptist Orthodox Church.
Right, and we discovered we had some common interests, such as English literature, theology, and a holistic approach to health and wellness.
Yeah, and so for quite a while, Jason and I have been planning to publish a regular podcast looking at some of these themes that we're interested in, specifically exploring current events through the lens of the great tradition. And Jason will tell us a bit more about what we mean when we talk about the great tradition.
Right. So we're talking about tradition has different meanings. You can talk about tradition in terms of customs, folkways, the things that have been done for a while. But at the broader level, tradition with a capital T, we're talking about things such as Western civilization as a whole, or even principles, institutions, practices that are just found universally across all humanity, what's called a philosophia perennis, or perennial philosophy, which is at the core of many civilizations. And then above all, the biblical and apostolic tradition, the teachings of the church. So that's what kind of we mean by this great tradition that's really embodied in classical traditional church teachings and large-scale Western civilization. And Robin and I have just found that a lot of these interesting little news stories that will come up about technology, education, politics, partisanship in America, we could really shed some light on them by making reference to this kind of classical philosophy and theology, especially things like classical ethics and patristic theology.
Right. And I will actually, today I wanted to just jump right into a hot current issue that we're seeing a lot of in the news right now. We're hearing a lot right now since sort of the middle of last month about technology and children. And I wanted to get Jason's feedback on some things I've been hearing in the news. And as you may have guessed, I'm talking about the groundbreaking study that was published in Nature Human Behavior on January 14th. And this study shows that there is apparently no connection between a child's technology use and their overall well-being. And just to give you some idea of the scope of this recent study, it included thousands of data sets spanning years, in which the upshot is that the association between digital technology and well-being is around 0.4%, which is not a statistically significant variation. And the media is just going crazy over this, is saying that we really don't need to have any concern about giving even our young children access to iPhones and different technologies. I have some specific questions I want to ask you about this, Jason. But first of all, could you just give us some big picture background on kind of how our culture looks at the role of studies and the important part that they play in shaping public opinion?
Right. Well, it's interesting you bring that up because just the words study and studies have a kind of magic, almost fetishistic value. Every culture places a certain worth or value on authoritative ways of determining what's true and what's false. So, for example, in the Middle Ages, it may have been theology and philosophy. In modern times, there's the emphasis on science. And studies are supposed to be authoritative, determining, and people can just say, well, a study has done this, therefore I'm going to change my diet. Or these studies say this, therefore we should do this policy. Now, I believe very strongly in the scientific method, but I'm also aware of the limitations of the scientific method. And people talking about fake news, a bigger concern, I think, than so-called fake news, which is a pretty controversial term, is an uncritical use of talking about scientific studies. Very often what's going on in the study just gets boiled down into a sensationalistic headline, basically reducing science to clickbait. And people are not aware of actually what the study says and how the study came up with it. So you're bringing up, say, this implication, well, we can let anybody, even let's say, I don't know, four-year-olds play around with tablets. A study like this is looking at data sets based upon questionnaires, based upon certain kinds of behavior. It's not immediately clear to me that from the study actually, say, would address the issue of very small children or toddlers using screen devices. But a bigger issue is, say, when talking about statistics, people think that they're about mathematics. And sure, statistics is a part of mathematics. We're dealing with numbers and formulas and calculations. What has always impressed me is how much statistics has in common with literary analysis. Because, in a whole number of ways, first of all, how do you know which facts you're looking for? How do you define your terms? How do you define your methods of measurement? How do you read your data? So the data we get from a study, even assuming that it's been collected in an objective and an efficient manner, reading them often offers a lot of the same problems as reading a poem or short story. It's a question of interpretative choices. So there's actually a quote from the article that really connects with that. So the authors say, scientists wishing to make inferences about the effects of digital technology using these data need to make numerous decisions about how to analyze, combine, and interpret the measures. Right, so making decisions about how you analyze, combine, and interpret the measures, this is why I think there's a strong analogy between statistics and reading literature. So what this means is that a study is not like some kind of authoritative oracle that's just based upon mathematics and experiments. Somebody is making a judgment, and you can accept that the data is perfectly valid, but still have a different opinion or judgment or interpretation of it. So instead of just relying on these stories in the news, we need to actually go back about them and talk about these studies.
Yeah, it's interesting you should say that, because I'm right now in my library science degree, I'm doing a course on research methods, and the professor said that a concern is that students go through modules where they learn to research and they become very good at collecting data, but not very good at being able to evaluate it. And I don't think we realize how much our worldview and philosophy plays a part in how we evaluate data. There's all sorts of choices that you make in what types of data you allow and how you organize it. And I want to go into some of those those details about this present study. But first, I just want to pick up on something you had mentioned. It seems, is it fair to say that the role of studies, particularly in the social science, almost functions like authoritative oracles in our cultures, or perhaps the role of a prophet in previous societies? Is that a legitimate way to look at it?
Yeah, I think the large measure it is. Part of it is what philosophers have called scientism. So taking science as the only way to study things, that somehow knowledge, reason, logic are equivalent to science. Now, by the way, talking about screen times and children and youth, I teach at a private high school in Estonia. I actually teach a course called Theory of Knowledge, which is looking at issues such as this. And I notice that when talking with a lot of my students, it's just this assumption that to know something means to prove something. To prove something means to do science. And in our society, we think either something is established by science or we don't know it at all. Either there's a scientific study or you're just going by your own emotions or personal subjective needs. Now, obviously, we can't have a policy or society that's run upon subjective needs. So it all ultimately comes down to we have science as the only thing that everyone can appeal to and accept as an authority. And there are a lot of problems with that.
Yes, interesting. So it's almost like people assume that there's only one way of achieving objective knowledge, only one way of knowing, and everything outside of that constricted method of knowing is just up for grabs.
Right, exactly.
And I want to say for the sake of my listeners, we are not anti-science, but we recognize it as one way of knowing among a host of different epistemological modalities. So I looked within this study because I wanted to see what criteria are they using to determine well-being, because that's a key point of their conclusion is that screen time makes no statistically significant difference on a child's well-being. And buried deep within the jargon-laden pages of the study, I mean, it reads like a mathematical treatise, very, very complex and jargon-laden. But if you wade through that, you get to the actual criteria of well-being that they're using, which relies heavily on a child's own self-assessment, as well as the parent's assessment of their son or daughter. And although the researchers also use criteria like absence of things like thoughts of suicide or symptoms of mental disorder, nevertheless, the subjective feelings of happiness and self-esteem, as self-reported by the youth, that formed a large part of the profile that they used to assess well-being. And so I wanted to ask, as a historian and philosopher, is the tendency that we see here to truncate questions of well-being to personal happiness and self-esteem, is that a particularly modern problem. And the other thing is this study didn't present any argument for using this very subjective criteria of well-being. They just assumed it and they incorporated that within the data sets that they collected and evaluated. Is this very subjective notion of well-being, which truncates it to someone's own self-report of their happiness and self-esteem, is this a particularly modern tendency?
Yes, I think it is a tendency that's very strong in the modern era. And let's say, define modern era as starting with the Industrial Revolution and the French Revolution. During that time, our understandings of goodness, well-being, happiness, very often influenced by a utilitarian view. And, you know, within utilitarianism, there are a lot of different forms of that. So John Stuart Mill himself wanted to have a more sophisticated kind of utilitarianism. He famously said the pleasures of Socrates are not the same kind of thing as the pleasures of a pig. But there is a tendency to reduce well-being or goodness to happiness and then happiness as pure subjectivity. In traditional philosophy, there's actually a distinction between that. And you find it most dramatically expressed in tragedy. For example, the famous tragedy of Oedipus. So within it, there's at the beginning, Oedipus is more or less satisfied with his life. He's dealing with a crisis in his kingdom. But as far as he's concerned, he's doing well. He's a king. He's a husband. He's a father. He does not know that his own actual objective condition is very messed up. He's actually in a wretched state, but he doesn't know it. And the whole power of the tragedy rests in the audience and the choir, seeing this sharp division between the objective state of Oedipus and his own self-conceptions, his own beliefs and feelings about where he is. And then in the epiphany, when he suddenly realizes the truth about himself, that's where the horror comes in. So that, again, that's just an extreme example. But maybe to make it less philosophical, there's a difference between, make it a little less technical, there's a difference between having subjective states such as emotions and being in an objective condition of flourishing and having achieved your potential as a human being.
I'm glad you brought that up, Jason, because when I look at a study like this that's looking at youth and screen time, I want to know more than just are these teenagers saying they're happy, and do they have an absence of symptoms that would be classified as mental disorders according to the DSM-5. I want to ask all sorts of additional questions that get to the heart of their objective well-being. How are their minds at problem solving, at out-of-the-box thinking, emotional intelligence, interpersonal skills, all these broader types of characteristics that should be part of the profile of well-being, and that doesn't even include questions of ethics and right behavior.
Yeah, well, you know, these studies authors are trying to get beyond only just self-reports of, say, self-esteem or subjectivity. They try to take account of some things, such as bullying or absence at school. Those are objective measures, but those are partial. You know, like you say, they're only a part of what's going on in the well-being of a youth or a child. So again, this comes back to the basic problem of someone simply citing a study, especially a study they haven't read, simply citing a study the way it's been reported in the news media. What those studies authors have been looking at, what they consider to be what's good for a child, may not be the same things you as a parent are looking for when making decisions about your children's use of screen time.
Yeah, and I'm just going to stop you right there because you bring in the issue of parents. And now That's very interesting because one of the criteria for well-being was the parents' own assessment of their youth. And I don't think people realize just how tricky that is because there's a lot of evidence that after the smartphone use hit 50% of the population, teenagers stopped being as rebellious and promiscuous as before. There's a lot of evidence for that. And it's something I've observed myself. Once smartphone use hit over 50% of the population, we saw a decrease in behaviors that are typically classified as rebellious. And on the surface, this may seem like a good thing from a parent's perspective, but what's better between a teenager becoming so passive when he gets home from school that he just lies in bed on his phone? Or someone who rebels and goes to wild parties. On the surface, most parents would probably say the former, but these are hard questions that we probably won't be able to fully grapple with until we have data from the present generation, long-term data over 20 or 30 years. And So even from a parent's perspective, these can be very very tricky questions, and we need to be asking how is technology helping with creativity, with the attributes that go into having a healthy brain, and so forth. And it's not as straightforward as this study is making out.
Right. So bringing up the question of passivity and conformity. So obviously there are some kinds of behavior that almost all parents would agree is not functional, that they don't want to have their children doing, say, drug abuse, spending too much time at parties, not doing schoolwork. On the other hand, virtue or excellence is more than just conforming to the institutional rules. It's taking an active interest in things and being creative. And as you were talking about this, something that came to mind is actually a study, by the way. So we'll use study against study, a famous one by John B. Calhoun about the failures of a mouse utopia. He created an artificial situation, a utopia for mice. It had everything a mouse could want. Warmth, lots of food, all the food they needed, chance to mate with other mice, socialize with other mice. And what he found was that the mouse population exploded, but after a while it began collapsing. And the key point, one of the inflection points showing the decline in the mouse population, was passivity in mice. That he found there were some mice, we called them, I forget the exact phrase, like beautiful mice or something, they would do nothing but groom themselves. They had no interest in really socializing with other mice or reproducing. They're just spending all their time grooming themselves. And eventually the mouse population collapsed. Now, society is not going to survive if our youth are able to have perfect attendance and do their homework, but can't do anything else. We cannot create, we cannot discover new things, we cannot build new things if the creative, active spark is extinguished in children. And frankly, I often wonder, I think for a lot of boys, probably would be better to spend 6 months sailing around the world or going hunting than going to a high school, which often is about conditioning people to be obedient little, you know, cubicle workers. Yeah, so it's, you know, a lot of questions here. What are we looking for in excellence, in well-being? What is virtue? What does it mean to be a good teenager? And how do we connect these with these studies? What exactly is going on with screen time? And again, it's not at all a matter of rejecting science or scientific method. I think the study is really good. I think it brings up a lot of good points. I think it's rigorous. It's something that I'll refer to later, but it's very partial. And I guess maybe that's the main point I want to get across, is that we should look at studies as resources that may be saying something good, but we should not make them final determinants, the judge giving the final sentence the way it's presented in the newspapers or the news media.
Yes, I completely agree. And we need to have greater training in among the broad population about how to read and how to look at studies like this. Because there are so many ways that people can go wrong or be misleading in how they evaluate the data. Charles Babbage, who was a 19th century Cambridge math professor, he described three ways that scientists can be unethical in collecting and analyzing data. First, there's what he called trimming, where you smooth out irregularities in the data to make something look more precise and significant than it really is. And then secondly, there's what we call cooking the data, where you discard information that doesn't fit with the conclusions you want to see. And then thirdly, there's forging data, where you invent information that isn't there. And these errors happen all the time, even within the contemporary context. So cooking is complex, because that cooking is when you discard information that doesn't fit the conclusion you want to see, or where you do not follow through on data that may be disruptive. And that can happen unconsciously when we have a philosophical bias, maybe without even realizing it. And then when we proceed to collect or evaluate data through the lens of that, the implicit philosophical position that we're assuming. And I'm wondering whether something like that is going on here in this study. Because if we go back to the claim that there's no correlation between screen time and well-being, we've talked about how the criteria that goes into determining well-being is actually a very highly complex philosophical question, and that's been debated for centuries. And the fact that many things that a lot of people would consider to be central to well-being, I mentioned some of them earlier, the fact that those aren't explored and the fact that data hasn't been collected on such things, interpersonal skills, out of the box thinking, creativity, imagination, emotional intelligence, etc. That seems to point towards a certain philosophical bias that the researchers may not even be aware of. And I know we're almost running out of time, but could you talk a little bit about how the philosophy of Aristotle might challenge some of these implicit philosophical assumptions about well-being, and how in the classical tradition, which was then taken up by much Christian theology and incorporated into Christian synthesis. How does that perspective maybe shed a different light on the question of well-being than what we find in this study?
Well, with Aristotle, the adjective that springs to mind to describe his ethics is holistic. He's looking at all of the faculties and capacities of a human being, and each aspect of human life has its own fulfillment, its own pathway to achievement. Generally, that's going to be a mean or middle condition between extremes. For example, we were just talking about teenage behavior. So on one hand, there's the extreme of a teenager who is completely rebellious, completely undisciplined, never conforms to anything, wild, hedonistic. Well, that's one extreme. And that's certainly not going to be well-being for an adolescent. On the other hand, there's something with a teenager or adolescent being too conformist, being too passive, following the rules too well, in which case there's no independence of thought, there's no initiative, there's no creativity. And that student might very well go through with decent or even excellent GPA and get some good SAT scores, but that student will achieve or accomplish nothing. So then, from an Aristotelian perspective, a successfully functioning teenager will have a mean between conformity to social rules and institutions and taking their own initiative, being a little creative. And even more broadly, say, obviously, of course, computers and laptops and smartphones did not exist in the time of Aristotle. But he did have experience with entertainment, with spectacle, with simulations. Ultimately, the human vocation for Aristotle is to know things. And to know things is more than just doing studies or counting beans. Knowledge means a deep communion, contact between the mind and reality. And this involves actually being in touch with nature, being immersed in nature. So from the Aristotelian perspective, there's a problem when a human being who's meant to be a rational animal engaged with the world is continually out of touch with nature through these simulations and pixels and images on screens. That would be very problematic from the Aristotelian perspective.
Interesting. So from Aristotle's perspective, knowledge is about more than just information. It's about having a well-ordered soul that has a proper relationship to his or her environment.
Oh, yes, definitely. You know, in fact, for knowledge, for Aristotle, is actually understanding of causes, of the principles of things, why something happens, and being able to take a phenomenon and understand it, explain it in terms of its causes. But doing so requires being in touch with reality. That's why Aristotle has a reputation as an empiricist, someone who values sense knowledge and nature. Aristotle was a great biologist. Of course, you know, his biology was new and young, and he had a lot of observations, conclusions, which have been, you know, outmoded, which have been declared outmoded or exploded by science. But the basic principle of being involved with the world, looking at how plants grow, at how animals behave, observing things and being in touch with those. And as you said, a well-ordered soul, having, and well-ordered in the sense not of passive conformity, but having a mean between extremes, being able to fulfill all these different parts of us in a harmonious, well-ordered way. This is an existential, practical precondition to being in touch with the world and trying to see things through causes.
Well, I think that's a very good note to end on, because we actually want to be using this Aristotelian framework later in future discussions to explore issues of in the contemporary world. And just as a kind of teaser of what's coming ahead, Jason, would you like to tell our listeners some of the types of things that we want to explore in upcoming episodes?
Sure. Some of the things, again, also about technology is, what is happening as we rely on computers and so-called smart technology? Is there actually such a thing as, say, smart homes? Is artificial intelligence actually really even possible for a society? Why are people becoming more and more angry? Is there growing tribalism in American society? What is the proper relationship between individual initiative, property, responsibility, and the collective, the community, and the state? What's the relationship between the state and the community? So issues such as, say, the rise of socialist rhetoric in America, questions about climate change, questions about so-called fake news, hoaxes, things like that. These are different kinds of things we can be discussing.
Good. And you can get updates about where our podcast and where we're going at my blog, robinmarkphillips.com. And we also will be releasing a Facebook page and a YouTube channel. So keep an eye out for those. Thank you for joining us today.
All right. Thank you, Robin.
Thank you for listening to today's broadcast. The Robin and Boom Show is made possible through the generous support of listeners like you. To become a patron of the show, go to robinmarkphillips.com and select the Robin Boom Show from the drop-down menu. If you have questions you'd like to have addressed on a future episode, send us a message through our Facebook page. Once again, thanks for listening.